First of all, thank you to Theo and Ben for inviting me. It's great to be here. It's great to be at the Institute. It seems an amazing place to be and do some research, so I'm very happy to be here. Okay, so I'll be talking today about unimodularity in the theory of tensor categories, and so let me start by just briefly telling you other places where unimodularity shows up. It's a very classical notion, and maybe you can find the roots of it in linear algebra in a very simple definition. So if we have a matrix, n cross n matrix with an integer entries, we call this unimodular if the determinant of A is plus minus 1. So something very simple, probably a name given to it long ago. And then variations of this idea are used in different fields to define the notion of unimodularity. So for example, if we have bilinear forms, we can associate a matrix to them. And so by that generalization, we can define the notion of a unimodular bilinear form. We have notion of unimodularity for lattices as well. And a fun fact, two of the famous unimodular lattices are the Leech lattice and E8 lattice, and they were like recently used in sphere packing results. So yeah, just something small connected. In other places, it also shows in the notion when there is a notion of unimodular toric varieties, because to them you have associated fans and you again have matrices showing up. So it comes up in many places. Even for Poisson algebras, there is a notion of unimodularity, because to Poisson algebra, we have associated notion of a modular derivation. So, and if this modular, so-called modular derivation is an element of the cohomology ring of the Poisson algebra, and if this is trivial, then call it unimodular.
Sorry, can you comment what this is telling me about Poisson algebra? I'm just not familiar with as much information.
Yeah, it's related to that. I don't know too much about it, but yeah, it's related to the Calabria property. Okay, and after that, it also appears when you talk about Lie groups, and more generally, if you talk about locally compact topological groups. And for such groups, we have the notion of left invariant and right invariant Haar measures. And for such groups are called unimodular if they admit a left and right invariant Haar measure. And if you have a Haar measure, what we can do is integrate functions on the group. And so Haar measures, you can also think of them as integrals for the group. And this is the terminology where used when we generalize the notion of unimodularity from these settings to today's agenda, which is Hopf algebras and tensor categories. So, let me briefly remind you what a Hopf algebra is. So a Hopf algebra, it consists of six pieces of data. So here we have something which forms a K-algebra. We have two maps, delta and epsilon, which make this vector space H a co-algebra. And we require that delta and epsilon are algebra maps. And lastly, we have this map S going from H to itself, which is called the antipod. And it has to satisfy certain relations. So the examples to keep in mind, first of all, is the group algebra. In a group algebra, we already know the algebra structure. The co-multiplication is defined like this. And the antipode corresponds to taking the inverse. So you can think of off-algebras as generalizing group algebras, where we have some general notion of inverse. More generally, if we take the universal enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra, that's Hopf. And we also have the quantum groups, which are their examples of Hopf algebra. So Hopf algebras can be thought of as encompassing, like they contain the theory of group algebras and Lie algebras between them. Right. And so how do we define unimodularity for Hopf algebras? To define that, we first come up with the right notion of integrals like we did for topological groups. And then if we have a two-sided integral, we call the Hopf algebra unimodular. So a left integral of H is some element lambda L inside H such that if you multiply on the left by any other element of the Hopf algebra, that's the co-unit times lambda L. And in a similar manner, we define a right integral to be some element lambda R, such that if we multiply lambda R by H on the right, that's epsilon H times lambda R. And lastly, we say H is unimodular if it admits a two-sided integral. Okay, so this characterization is akin to the one we saw for topological groups, but there's another way of saying it. If we take a left integral, there is a function which measures how far it is from being a right integral, and that is a function alpha, going from H to K. This measures how far a left integral is from being the right integral. And so this is like the modular function for the Poisson algebra, and we have something similar for topological groups as well. And so another way of characterizing a unimodular Hopf algebra is saying that this function is equal to the co-unit of the Hopf algebra. Okay. And so.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Hello from Zoom. So you gave some definitions of unimodular.
Right.
And one of the definitions was for a group. Good. And then another one was for the lattice. But are these definitions related at all, or?
So they can all be thought of coming from the definition I gave, first one from linear algebra. You usually have some sort of matrix coming up, or you have some other, like some similar way of coming up with a matrix. And then like if the determinant is one, you say that it's unimodular. And so this condition for Hopf algebras is also, you can think of like, we have a matrix corresponding to left multiplication and right multiplication, and we have some sort of common eigenvalue for them, which can be thought of as some generalization of the first definition I gave of unimodularity, where we want the determinant to be having determinant one. So yeah, there's just sort of variations of that. You can say the determinant one condition in different ways, like having left, right eigenvalues, or like something like that. Sorry, where's the camera? That's the camera, right? Yeah. Is that okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Right, some non-zero element. Yeah. We want it to be non-zero element, which satisfies these conditions.
I should have looked at this exercise, but I can't. You're saying already knowing zero is enough to get alpha to be just a function of not some sort of. Like, I don't know the formula for alpha. I don't know.
Oh. So what happens is the set of left integrals, they make an ideal of the Hopf algebra. So you can use that to show that for lambda L to be a right integral, we want lambda L times H to be epsilon H times lambda L, right? But what we can show is, since it's an these form an ideal, and actually they form a one-dimension ideal. So if you multiply on right, that will again be a multiple of this thing, but now there will be some other function, alpha. And so that's how this function alpha is defined. Its definition is this thing, alpha h times lambda l.
So geometric phase is failure, the invariant of the y-dimensional.
Sorry?
In the geometric situation, this is literally the failure to be invariant of the y-dimensional.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly how over here the left and right invariant, you define the difference between them. Yeah.
And the exercise I've done many times but don't remember how to do right now is this one dimensionality. If it's one at all, then it's a one dimensional space. That's the thing I have to remind myself of.
Right. It's not too hard.
You take H to be another.
Right. It comes out to be just a multiple of that.
Are you going to explain what this means for the category of phase functions?
Yes, that's what I'll be coming to next, yeah. But before I go into that, let me just tell you some examples separating Hopf algebras and all this. So I gave you the example of the group algebra that's an example of a Hopf algebra. And for instance, take the ground field to be just the complex numbers. And in this case, the Hopf algebra is a semi-simple algebra. So we have the class of semi-simple Hopf algebras. And it turns out the class of unimodular Hopf algebra, it contains the semi-simple ones. So, and that is very easy to show. If you take a Hopf algebra, which is semi-simple, and you take a left integral for that and a right integral to that, the product of them becomes a two-sided integral. And so that suffices to show every semi-simple thing is unimodular. And this is contained in the class of all Hopf algebras. So over here, you have non-semi-simple things, right? So if you studied Hopf algebras, this is a famous example of the Taft algebras. And you also have like some quantum groups which are not always unimodular. So you have things like this over here. But an example of something which is unimodular but not semi-simple is if you take a field K where the characteristic divides the order of the group. So that group algebra is no longer semi-simple but comes under the class of unimodular things. Also for a Hopf algebra, there is a notion of Drinfeld double of a Hopf algebra. That is, if you take something non-semi-simple, taking the Drinfeld double makes it unimodular. So that's an example which is not here, but it's in this class. Okay, so that's what we have in terms of examples. But now talking about what happens categorically. So let's go from Hopf algebras to tensor categories. So you can make a few observations. So first of all, we started with the Hopf algebra, which consists of following data. So first of all, we had that HMU. This is a K algebra. So what that does is it implies, if you look at this category of finite dimensional representations of H, this becomes a K-linear abelian finite category. Next, we had these two maps, delta and epsilon, which are K-algebra maps. And they make this category of H modules into so-called monoidal category. So if we take this category with the usual tensor product, then the tensor product of two H modules is again a H module. And we also have the ground field K, where the action is defined using the co-unit. And this becomes a monoidal category, Now we also had an antipode over here. And this antipode helps us give this category of rep H, a rigid monoidal structure, which means that just like for a vector space, we have a dual vector space. Now we have the notion of dual objects in this category. Okay. Now we have this function alpha from H to K. This is called the distinguished character. And this measures how far your Hopf algebra is from being a unimodular Hopf algebra. And there's an analog of this on the categorical level as well. If you take the one-dimensional module K, where the action of H is given by alpha, which means H acting on C is just alpha H times C. So this forms an object inside the category, which is called the distinguished invertible object. And when we have that D is isomorphic to the unit object of the category, which happens when K alpha is equal to the action on K by epsilon, we call C unimodular, or sorry, rep H unimodular.
Is this distinguished object related to the SO2 action?
Yes. Yes, so I'll come to that in a minute. So this generalizes directly the alpha equal to epsilon condition, which is used to define unimodularity of Hopf algebra. At a categorical level, this translates to this distinguished invertible object being isomorphic to the unit object of the category, right? And to answer your question, there is, in the theory of Hopf algebra, one of the first very foundational results was, if you have any Hopf algebra, the fourth power of the antipode, there is a formula for that. You can describe it as just H, but now you have some action of alpha inverse, and there is also a distinguished group-like element. You have like certain actions like this. But this this formula describes the fourth power of antipode in terms of just H. And this has an interpretation at the categorical level. This formula says that if you take the fourth dual in the category, that is isomorphic to conjugation by the distinguished invertible object. Okay. And this is related to like SO2 action. If you form like a three category of tensor categories, there is some action, and this formula can be interpreted as a topological factor. Yeah. Okay. So what happens is, let me draw another circle of now examples over here. So if your Hopf algebra is semi-simple, we get something called a fusion category. So again, the rep of group algebra is an example of a fusion category. But now we have inside that unimodular tensor categories. So there is a general notion of Drinfeld double of a category, so that will lie here. And then we have these things called over here tensor categories. So let me define what a tensor category is. So for me, a tensor category would be everything we observed here on the right hand side. It is a finite K linear abelian rigid monoidal category. And if we have such a category, there is a general formula for this distinguished invertible object. This can be defined as a coend like this. There is a coend formula. I should consult my notes to give you the right formula, but there is a formula which, like over here, we reference the Hopf algebra to define this. But given any tensor category C, we can define the distinguished invertible object without referring to the Hopf algebra. And that when that object is isomorphic to the unit object, we call the tensor category unimodular. Okay. All right, so yeah. So now is a good point to ask why should one bother with thinking about unimodular categories and unimodular Hopf algebras. And so there's a couple of reasons for that. As we saw in both pictures, unimodular tensor categories, they provide something in between the semi-simple and the non-semi-simple case. So often, if you want to generalize some result, it's proved for unimodular case first, and then people try to prove it for the general case. So if you have good understanding and examples there, it helps. Also, in the 1990s, people were trying to come up with various invariants of knots and three manifolds. And first, it was done with fusion categories, the semi-simple case. Like, for example, Cooperberg had a knot invariant using semi-simple Hopf algebras, and that was later generalized to use unimodular Hopf algebra. So it's, or rather spherical Hopf algebras, which have to be unimodular. So it's an important property if you want to construct some topological invariant out of your category. So you need unimodularity over there. And lastly, unimodularity, as I'll talk ahead, is related to Frobenius algebras inside the category. And there's a group in Hamburg who have realized two-dimensional CFTs categorically, and over there, Frobenius algebras correspond to correlators of the CFT. So I'm not an expert on this, but as far as I know, constructing examples of Frobenius algebra helps over there. So that's another reason why one might want to look at unimodular tensor categories. Okay. So let's see if I didn't miss anything. Right. So for this reason, one motivation for my project was to construct more examples of unimodular tensor category. So before I go to unimodular, what's a way of constructing just a new tensor category? And the most obvious and common one is using this notion of module categories, or rather C-module categories. So one can think of monoidal categories as categorifying algebras, and for algebras, we have modules. So similarly, for monoidal categories, we have C modules, and this consists of a category M with a functor which goes from C cross M to M. So a C module category is a category with an action of C, which means we have a functor like this, and this action has to be, it has to satisfy some conditions, which means that if we take tensor product of x and y in C and act on some object of the category, that has to be isomorphic to this, which in the case of vector spaces is just the axiom for a module action. And if we take the unit object of the category, that acting on M is isomorphic to M. Okay. And so let me add to the list over here. So if I want to understand what are rep H module categories, these are precisely H co-module algebras, which in particular include so-called co-ideal algebras, which are widely studied for quantum groups, which are particular examples of Hopf algebras. Okay. Now, if you want to do a nice theory, we impose some conditions on our monoidal category. We wanted finiteness, abelian, and so on. So we want to have some additional conditions on module categories as well, so that we obtain such a nice thing. So so first of all, we want our module categories to be abelian, k-linear. And in this setting, we call such a category exact. So we want to impose a homological condition if for all projective X object in C, and if you take any object M inside the module category, we want X acting on M to be projective in M. Okay. And it turns out that if we want to have a nice theory and avoid some pathological examples, we want to impose this nice condition. One of the main reasons to have this condition is a theorem of Ettinger of an Ostrich, which says that if you take C to be a finite tensor category and M to be a exact C module, then we can form this category of endofunctors of M. So we have a category, we can form the endofunctors of M, but we want them to respect the C module structure. And this thing is again a tensor category.
So I don't understand the definition of exact. So is gamma also
projective? No, X is projective and any object M.
So random and abelian category is not exact as a vector.
So being exact as a VEC module is equivalent to saying your module category is semi-simple.
Okay, that's what you want.
We don't want that. We want it to be exact as a C module, which is some generalization of that notion.
So exactly. So, but this is what it's supposed to be.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So it's some generalization of that. This is important because when we form the category of endofunctors, we want it to be rigid. And exactness is the thing which guarantees that if we take some endofunctor over here, that will have dual objects as well. So one thing we additionally want to impose is we want to just restrict to the set of right exact endofunctors. And also I should mention the condition being C module. So I said we have to look at endofunctors which respect the C action. That means that if we have some functor going from M to M, then F of X acting on M has to be isomorphic to X acting on FM. So it's again a categorification of what it means to be a map between modules. So that's the meaning of a C module functor. So this category, the objects are C module functors, which are right exact, and morphisms between them are C module natural transformation. So one can guess what the definition for that would be. Okay. So this for us provides a source of examples for tensor categories. And the question then is, when is NCM Rex unimodular? And so that's the subject of my paper, which I wrote over there. And
is there an asterisk theorem for exact motion terms?
Right, yes.
So you can,
sorry?
Are you gonna tell us?
I don't need it, but yeah, I can just say it. It just says, if you have an exact module category, you can find an algebra such that M is isomorphic to A modules in C.
But there must be some condition on that algebra that's not just being an algebra.
Yeah, so that's open, like that's something people have been trying to figure out. We don't exactly know like what should be the condition on A so that A modules is exact. Yeah, it is, okay, so since you asked about it, for at the level of Hopf algebras, it's known. So as I mentioned, if we take an H co-module algebra A, then if you look at A modules, that has an action of rep H, and that becomes a rep H module category. So that's the main source of examples for me. And in this case, if we look at this category, N rep H rep A, this is equal to some category of A bimodules inside the category of H co-modules. So understanding the question is, for this setting, is asking when this category is unimodular. And let me just add that. So rep A is exact as a rep H module category if two conditions are satisfied. If we A has an, it's a H co-module algebra, so we can form the space of co-invariants, and we want to be that to be isomorphic to K. And additionally, we want A as H simple from the right So it does not have any right ideals under the action of H. So I might be confusing this, but it's something like this.
So this must not be a form.
As far as I know, it's an if. So if this condition is satisfied, that gives us this. And this result is due to Scrabbing. Yeah.
Obviously, not if not be a form.
Right.
And does anybody know if that is?
I don't know. Maybe there's one that exists, but as far as I know, there isn't one. And so this was also a difficult result to prove. It requires quite a bit of homological arguments, and so it's difficult to generalize it to a categorical level. We want to prove it for monoidal categories. We want some sort of diagrammatic proof or something like that so that you can lift it. But at least in this case, we get a rich source of exact module categories. So an important consequence of this result is that if we take A to be an exact H comodule algebra, which means this is exact, then A is a Frobenius algebra. So that means that we have a map going from A to K, whose kernel does not contain a left ideal. Okay. So that's one of the many ways of characterizing Frobenius algebra. So because of this, we get this, which gets us a good handle on exact module categories for rep H.
I'm just thinking H is Hungarian or no?
No. It's Frobenius algebra means just you have some map, yeah. Yeah, this not necessarily. Yeah.
In a pretty general question, I don't know.
Right.
So if I want to think about this in terms of TFT, 3D TFT, the boundary condition and the boundary lines is line one category H mod.
Right.
And then to get A mod, I have some corner. And then if I want to consider this endo functors, I'm looking at another.
Yeah, it's just really like modulo issues of whether the boundaries are sufficiently generated. You have the 3D theory, as you said, H mod is on one side, mod is like where this. So boundaries are tensor, choosing tensor categories for the given theory.
Oh, you see, so this endomorphism to A mod is
one. Endomorphism to A mod is literally the other guy. And then the corner is A mod itself.
So from this perspective, it should always be A mod, because A modular is a statement of block.
Isn't that wrong? The modularity is explicitly about the boundary. It's about the whether the SO something action on the bulk. There's some sort of SO equivariance in the bulk.
It's so between the bulk.
And you're asking for that to play nicely on them. So it's literally about asking for a sort of extension of symmetry, of SO structure from the bulk symmetry. It's a different memory, it's like a different, like one of them might end up with extension of memory. But I have to track exactly what it is, unless it's a few uses.
Yeah, so.
That's a possibly naive question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, in the picture that you drew, like on the.
Right.
So if I have a locally compact leaf, I can form like the universal functions on that leaf, which involves like taking computations norm to the ultimate norm. So I'm just wondering where that thing fits in this picture.
I think in general that would be non-semi-simple, but again you will have some condition. I'm not completely sure, but maybe that is equivalent to like the locally compact group being unimodular.
It's
really
good.
You
have
to respect to our measure.
Right. Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But do you need it to be the same? You just need a left integral, one, right?
Right, but the point is that the right integral will be integration with respect to right integration.
Yes.
Okay. All right, yeah, so, yeah, as I said, the main problem I was concerned with is when is this example, which is one of the first examples of constructions of new tensor categories out of known ones, when is this thing unimodular? And the result we obtained was following. So this is mostly just using a result of Shimizu, Fuchs, Kalindo, Jaklisch, and Schweigert, and then adding a little bit of it. So it's mostly their result. And the result says that, so it says the following are equivalent. And so the first one is this category NCM X is unimodular. The second criteria, I'll write it down and then explain the notation. The Serre functor of this module category correspond composed with the Nakayama functor. It's isomorphic to the identity functor on M as a C module functor. Okay, so let me tell you what these mean briefly. So when we have C acting on a module category, so first of all, M is just an abelian category. And for example, if M is equal to A mod, then we have a famous functor of A dual tensor dash from A mod to A mod, something like this. And Nakayama functor is a generalization of this for any abelian category. So the Nakayama functor for A mod is exactly this thing, but in general, it's defined using integrals. And this is, again, a functor which helps us study module categories. And using this, we can obtain many properties of the distinguished invertible object. But let me not say more about it. I'll come back to it if there's need for it. But also, when we have C acting on a module category, we have the notion of internal HOM. So the internal HOM of any two objects, M, N, belonging to M. So let me just say this is called the Nakayama functors, because it generalizes the Nakayama functor studies for just algebras. So this internal HOM is defined as just the HOM, a notion of right HOM, like the correct notion of HOM space between two objects of the module category. And its definition is given like this. If we have X acting on M for any X and C, this is isomorphic to HOM C of X, comma. So it's for any two object of the module category, it's an object which represents this functor of X tensor dash comma dash. So it's the right object corresponding to this. So if you want to do algebra inside this module category, one important thing is we need to have a notion of HOM space between them. And it turns out that when we have C acting on M, M is enriched over the category C, and we have this notion of HOM, which is an object lying inside the category. So there's a lot to say about this, but I'll just stop here for now so that I don't take too long. This S is a functor which is called the relative Serre functor. And I'll say in a moment why it's called that. And it's defined as a endofunctor of the module category equipped with an isomorphism like this. So again, to do algebra inside the module category, we need to have a handle on these internal HOMs and how they behave with respect to duality. And the relative Serre functor is defined to be an endofunctor which satisfies this property. And this notation is, again, lifted, like borrowed from algebraic geometry, where we have such functors which correspond to the dual between Hom space being isomorphic to something like this. And over there, it's called a Serre functor. And since we are working in like the setting relative to C, because M has an action of C, it's called a relative Serre functor. And such a functor exists if and only if the module category M is exact. So whenever a module category is exact, it satisfies this homological condition. We have some handle on what the dual should be. And so these are two endofunctors of the module category. And so their composition is, again, an endofunctor. And it turns out the unimodularity is equivalent to this composition being isomorphic to the identity functor. Yes?
So as Lurie explained in his TFT paper, a Serre functor for TFT is about an SF2 action.
Right.
So is this why do you expect this to be true?
So, I mean, it turns out that if you look at this category of endofunctors, the distinguished invertible object, which as we discussed over here, like we have this property, this fourth dual, which corresponds to the SO2 action, that algebraically translates to this property.
I mean, so if H was the ground field, then this statement is in Lurie's paper.
Whose paper?
Lurie's paper about TFTs.
Okay.
Then M, 2D TFT.
Right.
M is the kind of fault lines.
Right.
And the 2D TFT is SO2 invariant. If
right.
You realize the Serre functor.
Okay.
And that means you get the SO2 varieties, you can modulate fault lines.
I see.
Just
because
the
Serre functor actually is not a Yamaha functor. Like the SO2 Serre functor is like a Yamaha. And the other Serre is not a
I think I didn't fully understand lots of things. But that was
right. I mean, so what Lucas is saying is that in the sort of absolute case where C is critical, I think the Nakayama functor
the same as Serre.
I see. So this is like you're kind of generalizing this characterization of SO2 varieties to T to valid to Serre.
That's
right.
So now I want to ask you in conversation: do you in your statement here in C is already modular?
No. So the nice thing is C may be not unimodular, but the category of endofunctors might be unimodular. And
for some reason,
I'll give an example of
still doing rotation or which confuses me.
I'm confused by SO3 being C by 2 or by SO2 being C. I think we have here square the Serre functor or something like that.
So this Serre and Nakayama functor, they are related by, I might get the inverse wrong, but I think this is the distinguished invertible object acting on the Serre functor. And that means that this action means D acting on S of M, which is an object of the category. So that's what this notation means. So they are related by this property. So in essence, you have squared up to an object, which is the distinguished invertible object of C.
So if C is correct, then this means square of the Serre functor.
Right, or if C is unimodular in general.
Okay,
right.
So that explains the pi 1 of SO3, it seems.
Right, vect is semi-simple, so D vanishes over here, and we just get Serre squared.
So,
yeah.
That's probably the two different notations. If I'm in SO3, I can different answer. That's why your position is what's it? That's how you do the thing.
Yeah.
One of us has the other
one. Right. And how many years have this stinky case?
Now, this is already, there's no, like, this bulk theory is not properly recorded. Because the bulk theory is. Well, just trivialize 720-degree rotation, just that is trivial. Yeah, I think if you count dimensions, the destruction to lifting from spin to frame, or the destruction descending from frame to spin, it's just a property, not data. And I think for some reason this property is always satisfied, at least in all of these examples. And so these are all already on the spin. And that's why it would make sense to anyway think about the sword instead of the clear path. That would be interesting for me.
Yeah.
But I do like that this is common. This is really purely SN. It's like rotate this way and rotate that way.
Yeah, no, thanks for the remark. I should look at that paper. But yeah, we have a couple of other characterizations of this unimodularity as well. We have a functor psi which goes from the Drinfeld center to NCM, and it takes an object of Drinfeld center, which is an object with a half braiding, and it maps to this functor of C acting on whatever the second slot is, and the C module structure is defined using the half braiding. So we always have such a functor. And the another characterization is that psi right adjoint of this functor. So we assume a bunch of finiteness conditions, so the right adjoint exists. And that evaluated at the identity functor in this category is a Frobenius algebra. In the Drinfeld center. So we get an algebraic characterization, and in fact, we can make it more stronger. This is equivalent to the right adjoint. Sorry? It'll be commutative, yes. Sorry. So what happens over there is whenever we have a functor between rigid category, which is a strong monoidal functor, the image of the right adjoint at unit is a commutative algebra. That's always true. So what happens is this psi, this.
So why? I totally believe you that the right adjoint algebra is algebraic, but why is it?
So it won't be commutative on any object, but just on the identity object. So if I take the identity here, which is the identity functor on M, it sends that to a commutative algebra. And this is probably an algebraic reason, maybe not that convincing. Yeah. This thing, a Hopf adjunction, kind of. And so it makes the unit object a bit special.
No, I see. And it's like, this is what your, this algebra is like what our back reconstructs from this functor, so it should be convinced of the right second.
Yeah.
I'm
imagining.
Right.
We're building a line in the bump. How do you do this for this kind of band recognition?
That's exactly.
Exactly.
I would just miss somewhere.
Yeah, your point is also correct. The modules over this algebra in ZC would be isomorphic to this by Barbeck, and then it's monoidal, so it should be commutative. Yeah. Okay. Right. But we can make this a bit stronger and say that this is a Frobenius monoidal functor. So in fact, it won't just take the unit object to a Frobenius algebra. If I take any Frobenius algebra here and apply this functor, the output will also be a Frobenius monoidal functor. Sorry, a Frobenius algebra in the Drinfeld center. So,
is there some sort of like left adjoint versus right adjoint model? Like, is it this?
Right. So, another way of characterizing this would be saying that the left adjoint and right adjoint are isomorphic. So, unimodularity is equivalent to that as. Yes. So notation for that is psi is a Frobenius functor, which means it's both adjoints are isomorphic. Yeah. And in fact, we can make this a bit stronger. And we can obtain that if C is a pivotal finite tensor category, which means that the double dual functor is isomorphic to the identity functor as a monoidal functor. Okay, so that's what pivotal means. We have a monoidal natural isomorphism between these two functor, and we take M to be so let me say in this case we call M unimodular. So if you take M to be unimodular and again a pivotal module category, and the definition of pivotality for module category is the serf functor is isomorphic to the identity functor on M. Okay. So yeah, this also happens, and in this case we can say more about this thing. In this case, the functor psi right adjoint is a pivotal Frobenius monoidal functor. So in this case, we know C is pivotal, so its double is pivotal. But in fact, this category of endofunctor also becomes a pivotal category. So the serf functor is like a dual, corresponds to the dual in this category. And if it's trivializable as a C module functor, then the target category is pivotal. And in fact, the right adjoint preserves the pivotal structure. So if we have a so-called symmetric Frobenius algebra here, the output here would be a symmetric Frobenius algebra. And again, symmetric Frobenius algebras are something which people who look at, some people in Hamburg, they like because they correspond to correlators in CFT. They're also used, if you have symmetric Frobenius algebras in a braided category, you can form local modules over it and get new braided categories. So yeah, that's one reason to for this result to be interesting. Okay, so I was talking over here, and we defined the notion of a module category being unimodular, and we found an answer for this. But again, my main source of example is Hopf algebras, and over now we know what it means for a module category to be unimodular. So a question would be, when is a module category from a co-module algebra? So when is this thing unimodular? And so that's what the remainder of my talk would be, which will probably take 5-10 minutes. And that's where I get all my main examples from, some non-trivial examples. But let me just give you first some very simple examples. C acts on itself by tensor product. And then C is unimodular. C acting on C is unimodular. If I take M to be just C, if and only if C is unimodular as a tensor category. So if you just take the module category to be C, we recover the usual notion. And if we have this category rep H, and we have a fiber functor going from here to VEC, and this makes VEC a rep H module category. Okay, and in this case, what happens is N rep H of VEC is isomorphic to rep H star. So VEC is unimodular as a H module category if and only if H star is a unimodular Hopf algebra. So if you're looking at just at the level of Hopf algebra, it generalizes the notion of unimodularity. You can talk about unimodularity of H, H star, and also things in between them using this notion. Okay. So now let's talk about Hopf algebras.
Sorry, I didn't quite get the last example. That's a kind of Fourier transform, right? Like that statement. So do you need H to be unimodular? I guess that's the statement.
So this statement says that VEC is unimodular rep H module if and only if this category is unimodular by definition, and that happens if and only if the Hopf algebra is unimodular.
be able to talk about things like the modular, it's called the modular.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So, yes, now we. I'll end with answering this question, which was another main part of my paper. And this, to do this, we need to introduce some notation. As I said, by results of Scriabin, I think it's already written there. No. Scriabin, if we take A to be a left H co-module algebra, so it implies A is Frobenius. And if we have a Frobenius algebra, we can make our life a little easier. So that by definition means we have a map from H to K. Yeah, you're right. It is an exact H left H co-module algebra. So the result of Scriabin, which characterized exact H co-module algebras, that meant that if we take it to be exact, which means that the co-invariants are trivial and it's simple, it has no H ideals, then it's a Frobenius algebra. So that means we have a Frobenius form, which is a map like this, and we can take a dual basis of A. So I need to make sure I don't write the wrong thing here. Yes, so we can take dual basis AI and BJ of A, and this, the kernel of this containing no left ideal can be written like this. Lambda AI BJ is equal to delta IJ. So we can, by the virtue of this being a Frobenius form, we can choose a dual basis such that this happens. And I'll need one more notation. For every Frobenius algebra, we have a so-called Nakayama automorphism. So this is something which can we can associate to every Frobenius algebra. This is a map going from A to A, and it is defined by this property that lambda evaluated at AB is equal to lambda nu BA. And whenever we have a Frobenius algebra, such a map exists. And I was talking about the Nakayama functor over there. If A is a Frobenius algebra, this actually corresponds to M mapping to M twisted by this action of the Nakayama automorphism. So that's another reason for calling it the Nakayama functor of a module category. Okay. So yeah, recently I should mention Fuchs, Scheugert, Schaumann have done a lot of work on using the Nakayama functor. So they came up with a way of describing it without referencing the algebra A. So using ends and coends, defining it for any module, any category, and using that, they are able to generalize this Radford isomorphism a lot. All right, so coming back, we want to answer this question. And to answer this question, I proved this result, which says that this module category rep A is unimodular if and only if A admits an invertible element which I call G tilde, which satisfies two conditions. First one is, if I conjugate any element of A by G that is equal to alpha evaluated at, so I'm using some notation, I'll explain it to you in a minute. So this alpha was the distinguished character we mentioned at the beginning of talk. So this is the distinguished character of the Hopf algebra. Here we have a map rho, which is, since A is a H co-module, we have a map from A to H tensor A. And this map is written in this notation, A minus 1 tensor A 0. So that's the minus 1 and 0 subscripts. And the second part is, we have one more condition, the unit of H tensor G tilde, it's equal to an element tau times rho G tilde, where again rho is the coaction over here. And this tau has a little bit complicated expression. I have it in my note, but I don't think writing it will help. If you want to know it, I can show it to you later. But the point is, we get a very explicit answer to this question of unimodularity in this case. We just need to find an element which satisfies these two conditions, and we find examples of unimodular module categories. So while in this case, in general, this seems like a complicated expression, but when you work in specific example, that simplifies quite a lot. And in fact, we find an interesting example. If we take C to be rep of the Taft algebra, so let me tell you what a Taft algebra is. So as an algebra, it's a K-algebra generated by two element, X and G, and modulo some relation. So the importance of these algebras is in the beginning of the theory of Hopf algebras, when we knew the definition of antipode, it was not known whether the order of the antipode is bounded or not, which corresponds to at a categorical level, if you taking dual, will we hit X at some point, or like will it stop? And Taft algebras were the first examples where you can increase like this X to the N, like we can increase N and you get higher Taft algebras, and the order of antipode keeps increasing. So these were quite an important first example, like and while the theory of Hopf algebras was young. But what I show for this particular example is this category does not admit a unimodular module category. So another way to say this is the Morita equivalence class of C does not contain a unimodular tensor category. So this is interesting because for many results, what we want is we want to understand the tensor category up to Morita equivalence, because many results just depend on the Drinfeld center, like for example, the Turaya-Viro invariant. And this tells us that there are examples of things which are purely non-semi-simple, that even up to Morita equivalence, they are not related to something unimodular. So we can refine this picture over here. Right, we can make this bigger. And so we can define something called weakly unimodular if it's related by Morita equivalence to something unimodular. And we found an example over here, the representations of the Taft algebra, which is not weakly unimodular. And so an interesting problem would be to find a better description of what weakly unimodular categories are. But at currently, the theory of tensor categories is very much at the beginning. We don't even know classification of fusion categories, which are the semi-simple case. But maybe this will help us like separate and find what these specific cases are. So yeah, something I'm wondering about is, what are these weakly unimodular categories? Is there a way to characterize them? Another way of thinking about that is, what are these purely non-semi-simple things like Taft algebras, which are not related to anything unimodular, even our bimorita equivalence? Okay, so that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Questions?
Example I find really cool is that at least the way you presented the Taft algebra looks like a Heisenberg double kind of construction.
Oh, I see.
What, like, do you know if it's possible to write it as some kind of Heisenberg double? Like, it's not the Drinfeld.
Yeah.
for a double. And it turned out that like
so
basically a sign, and then suddenly it becomes like this
right.
Bad.
So I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the Heisenberg double, but what I can say is there is a paper of Ettinghoff and Galacki where in certain special cases, not in general, we can realize the Taft algebra as maybe like using some doubles. Like in, but that happens only in some, no, I'm sorry, that's probably wrong. They use the Taft algebra to realize quantum groups in certain specific cases. So these cannot be realized by doubles because they are not unimodular and doubles are unimodular, so that cannot happen. But maybe by Heisenberg double they can be, but I'm not familiar with that construction, how the Heisenberg double is defined.
Suppose that I cared about slightly more infinite categories.
Yeah.
For instance, I can the next class of the different categories after finite number of categories is these are really categories with length. In a sense, that's I think what the sensor categories are called.
Right.
Have you looked at that? How much? Have you eyeballed how much of this thing?
Right. No, so that is quite interesting, and the main reason being another examples for tensor categories is through vertex operator algebras. And over there, you don't have all the finiteness properties in many of the examples. So I, in particular, work in the finite setting, but many of the results, like for example, this result has just recently been generalized by Shimizu and Shibata to the setting where you can have infinitely many objects. So they call these Frobenius tensor categories, where for a finite category, you have four axioms, like enough projectives, locally finite and finitely many simples. They get rid of the finitely many simple condition and obtain this Radford isomorphism.
It's the class I was thinking of, I would have thought the natural class doesn't.
Right, yeah. Unfortunately, for proving results like this, enough projectives is needed. And I don't think many of these fundamental results have been generalized beyond enough projective setting. Another thing could be like some of these results in the infinite setting are more natural with this Grothendieck-Verdier rigidity. So that is also something that's quite active and results are being proved. But for like the usual rigidity, which we are accustomed to, I think it has only gone up to the point where you relax the finitely many objects condition.
Happens, I mean, you mentioned the sweet unimodularity. What happens if I somehow try to transfer unimodularity on non-metric equivalence? Is there anything I can do there? It's just impossible.
Yeah.
If I know C as unimodular, I have more metric equivalence to C5. Do I know anything about C5?
As far as I know, it is. Yeah. I mean, weakly unimodular things are, sorry. Things which are Morita equivalent, one way to say that is they have the isomorphic Drinfeld doubles, but then this unimodularity information is kind of lost in the Drinfeld double. So I'm not sure. You can say some things about like pivotality and other sphericality, but about unimodularity, I'm not sure. Like if one category is pivotal and then something Morita equivalent to it is so-called quasi-pivotal, which means it's pivotal up to conjugation by some object. But about unimodularity, I'm not sure.
Yes, what's
your
wake-up
and
want us to do this problem? Let's take the ball. Let's pick a unimodular for another boundary distance to study in the correspondence. So, so now having one unimodular boundary just that gives you more access to these modules, perhaps.
Yeah.
In the actual proof, so you enumerated sometimes a scheme theory diagrams person. Is the paper kind of diagram full, or is the paper all partials?
Yeah, it's full of things like this, minus one, zero. Lots of use of Swedler notation and Hopf algebra. Yeah, it's this was, yeah, like finding this, it involves lots of calculation with Hopf algebras. But maybe one thing interesting I would say is this remark. So one open question about Hopf algebras is, if you take a Hopf algebra such that H dual is semi-simple, then the conjecture is that H is unimodular. Another way of, this is something called Kaplansky conjecture, a weaker form of that, and that is still open in characteristic non-zero. And one can phrase that in terms of unimodular module categories as well, as in saying that VEC is a unimodular module category for rep H when H is semi-simple, something like that. So, that just says like even in the simple module category, we don't know in that setting like whether the dual is unimodular or not.
Seeing no more questions.